Senate Health and Human Services Committee. We are short a quorum, but we also have a lot of people here that would like to make comments on the governor's proposals, and we have a number of people on our list who've asked to present testimony. We're going to try to do this expeditiously and give people a chance to comment. This will probably extend into tomorrow. We've tried to communicate with people who've indicated their desire to talk, to make some presentation, to try to limit their presentation to 2 to 3 minutes, which would then also allow, if there are any questions from committee members, and just out of respect for the number of people that we have and the relative short time that we have in the session to get through things. So I'm going to go ahead and begin with, we'll just take, if people, I think there are copies of the agendas available for people, but we're just going to go down the list and start at the top, and that first person is Mr. Sam Grabarski from the Minnesota Downtown Business Council. Welcome to the committee, and I just ask all presenters, please bring the microphone close so that we can catch your remarks on tape and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have additional copies of my testimony if they don't reach to all the members of the committee. I'm Sam Grabarski, the president and CEO of the Minneapolis Downtown Council. We are the largest central business district association in Minnesota, formed many decades ago to represent the businesses located in downtown Minneapolis on matters related to economic growth, safety, transportation, and public policies. I'm here to recommend continued funding for three vital programs under this committee's jurisdiction: the Group Residential Housing Program, the General Assistance Program, and Emergency General Assistance Program. These programs keep single homeless adults off the street. I'm here to report today that those programs have triggered several hundred thousand dollars from the private sector in the past year. The Downtown Council formed a partnership with the downtown congregations to end homelessness to create the Curry Avenue Partnership, named after the homeless shelters on Curry Avenue. In the past year, we raised $400,000 to move over 150 people out of the shelters into group residential housing, improving their lives, reducing misdemeanor crimes, and causing sharp reductions in complaints about loitering. The average person housed has lived in the shelters for at least a year. We launched the Downtown 100 project a year ago by supplying $300,000 to cause the tireless focus of caseworkers, prosecutors, and a probation officer on the chronic 100 criminal offenders in downtown. The Hennepin County Court told us that over time, each of the chronic 100 had cost taxpayers $3 million, it's worth reporting and repeating, $3 million each in social services, jail time, and medical treatments. The business community thought we could do better. Many were homeless and now live in group residential housing and have committed no crimes, repeat, no crimes in over a year. We've achieved a whopping 70% reduction in crime among the downtown 100 in less than a year. We've decided to step up to the task of maximizing the effects of your investments. We don't ask you to increase funding for group residential housing, the general assistance program, and the emergency assistance program. We just ask that you don't decrease it. Keep us on the hook to supply more private sector dollars. Commerce in downtown Minneapolis is dependent on effective management of our streets and on the elimination of livability crimes. With your support, we have assembled the teams and the leaders to make a real difference for the homeless and to improve our community in general. Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions or beg to be excused.
All right. Choice. Thank you, Mr. Grabarski. And Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Grabowski, thank you very much for coming today. It's very important for us to hear about the good work that you're doing, and I do applaud your work. One of the proposals that you haven't mentioned in your testimony is the proposal to significantly reduce residential treatment services, and I, for one, am concerned about how that will affect crime in my district, which is very close to downtown Minneapolis, and I'm wondering if you have any concern about that as well.
Mr. Grabowski.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, yes, of course we have a concern over that. I wanted to make certain I spent my brief testimony on these two programs where we have actually made, as you've heard, $700,000 in investments in just 1 year. The important thing is that the business community is aroused to listen to how we can help now in a way that we never were before, thanks in part to your good leadership and our relationship with you on these issues. We're told by Hennepin County Medical Center, for instance, that people who are homeless must remain for extended periods of time in emergency care at that hospital if they don't have a residential location to go to for continued medical treatment and recovery. Perhaps that relates in some way to the issue that you've raised. And we think, again, why would we spend that money when we could do better with an investment in the right location? So we will remain open to whatever this committee wants to challenge us with if it helps improve the quality of life for the people involved, if it helps reduce crime in downtown Minneapolis, if it makes our community more livable.
Thank you, Mr. Grabowski. I appreciate your coming here this this afternoon. I have also had an opportunity to meet with Charles Cudd, who I know has been a part of your good work down in the downtown area, and a chance to at least talk about some of those things in greater detail, so I appreciate that.
Very good, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee, for your attention. I'll sign this and return it to the table.
Thank you. Next, we have Angel Buchner. Welcome to the committee. I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
You did.
All right. Please identify yourself and bring the microphone close so we can catch you on tape.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Angel Buchner, and I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. The Welfare Rights Committee is an organization of parents and families who are current or former welfare recipients who are living in poverty, are low income, or working poor. We would like to remind this committee that families who have no other choice but to receive welfare are forced to live at over 60% below the federal poverty level. Poor families in Minnesota have not seen an increase in the welfare grants in 25 years. That means that a family of three who received a mere $6,384 per year to live on in 1986 is still receiving $6,384 today. That is $532 per month. $532 does not even cover or come near to covering rent. So for years, this legislature has been condemning families with children to homelessness. We also would like to remind this committee that we are still in an economic crisis and that we are the last ones hired, but the first ones laid off. We are glad to see that the governor's budget does not steal more money from MFIP grants, but the reality is millions have been stolen from TANF funds in previous years, and those millions could have gone to undoing huge suffering in this state. This means that our families can no longer tolerate having the budget balanced on our backs. We'd like to speak against some of the cuts to low-income and working people in the governor's proposed budget. The cut in consolidated funds to counties could result in more counties eliminating emergency assistance for the poor. When the so-called consolidated fund was created, it was to hide a huge cut to the poor. Reducing the consolidated fund means more cuts that will hurt workers and poor families. The cuts in Minnesota care mean that over 7,200 will no longer have health care. The merging of the emergency general assistance and emergency MSA will have the effect of creating more homelessness, since those funds are used as we are forced to bounce around apartments at the bottom of the housing market. We like to speak against taking $14 million per year from the TANF fund to go into the child care and working family tax credit. If this state really respected the idea of helping to provide child care and the working family credit for low-income working families, it would ante up from the general fund, not take money that is meant for the poorest of the poor. We say that not one dime of cuts should come out of programs for poor and working people. We have borne the brunt of the budget deficit for years, and our programs have been shaved to the bone. We also urge y'all not to pass any bills that will hurt our families economically, not to pass any bills that would criminalize poor families, not to pass any bills that eliminate or make it even harder to receive the services that we need to survive during this economic crisis. On the other hand, we do applaud the governor's proposal to tax the rich. While we have paid for the budget deficit with our blood for many years, the wealthiest in Minnesota have not paid even one dime. In fact, they have gotten richer and richer at the expense of poor and working Minnesotans. While we applaud the governor's tax increase, we say it is not nearly enough. Look at the facts. If the governor's proposal to raise taxes on 5% of the population with the most income results in over $3 billion, this signifies just how much the state of Minnesota has been losing in tax income year after year because the rich have not paid their fair share and because of the massive tax breaks they have benefited from. This is incredible. It also means that the riches have amassed billions of dollars in extra income year after year, while the rest of the people in the state have been living in desperate times. We feel the rich should actually pay back the wealth they have gained at our expense, and in this time of budget crisis, that this state should be prioritizing the survival needs of families and individuals and who are coping with disabilities, unemployment, in this time of overall economic crisis.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Seeing no questions, Sue Abderholden from NAMI.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Minnesota. I will be brief this afternoon. I'm sure you're glad to hear that. The first point that I'd like to make is about the Children and Community Services Act. While the new forecast has allowed the governor to reduce the impact in terms of cutting that, it's still a $5 million cut, and it will only now be directed to child protection and vulnerable adults. And I just want to remind people that 16% of those funds were going to the children's mental health system and 6% to the adult mental health system. So that is a loss of funding for both of those. The second is the Medicare and Medicaid crossover payments. We believe that this will impact mental health professionals who treat adults. We have asked the Department of Human Services for a listing of who will be impacted by that, as did Senator Sharon last Friday, but I think we really need to get a handle on that. I will say that Medicare has, for a very long time, discriminated against mental health, both in terms of what they cover and their payment rates, so it disproportionately affects mental health providers. We do have a workforce shortage in Minnesota. I don't think that we need to make that even worse by lowering the payment rates. The other issue is just the CADI waiver. We under the community alternatives for disabled individuals, which is used by people with mental illness. We understand that some of the funding cut was being put back because of the last forecast, but we're not sure exactly how that's being done, whether it's the number of people who can go on the CADI waiver or the payment rates. I will just underscore that the people with mental illnesses who have the most serious ones, they use the CADI waiver as a major vehicle to moving out of long-term residential treatment, including nursing homes, into the community. So it is a cost-saving measure for people with a serious mental illness, including children. We do appreciate the fact that the governor protected the funding of mental health services and treatments, and we ask that as you move forward, you also protect those services. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abernholt. Next, Karen Sames, Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association. After that, we'll have John Cheetah from the Courage Center. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Hahn, committee members. My name is Karen Sames. I'm a volunteer at the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association. I'm here to ask you to reject the governor's budget proposal for human services changes to the prior authorization process for rehabilitation services and the elimination of specialized maintenance therapy. Last year, occupational therapy took a 40% reduction in the number of units of service that could be provided before prior authorization was required. This year, DHS has proposed two changes, the elimination of both the therapy thresholds and specialized maintenance therapy, that will result in an estimated cost savings in rehabilitative services equal to the amount of money the department needs to fund a new computer system. Specialized maintenance therapy is provided by occupational therapists, is a skilled, medically necessary service, and cannot be duplicated by others who are untrained as licensed occupational therapists. Last year, when DHS proposed eliminating specialized maintenance therapy, their own figures suggested that 70% of the cost savings would actually shift elsewhere. In this year's proposal, they're silent on the topic of cost shifting. Our greatest concern is that DHS plans to expedite the prior authorization process when they implement their new computer system. With the proposed elimination of thresholds, DHS proposes that algorithms will be designed for simple rehab diagnoses, and units of therapy will be assigned based on that algorithm. We do not think that an algorithm can adequately address patient severity and complexity and measure patient conditions and outcomes. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, have been working without success for over 5 years to develop a system to ensure appropriate utilization and payment for outpatient therapy services. During that time, CMS found, and I quote, "Using the primary diagnosis on a claim is a poor predictor for the type and duration of therapy services required." Concern about over or under utilization of the threshold units could be monitored by case review and investigated by the current DHS Surveillance and Integrity Review Services, SIRS. This utilization data is available to DHS and is a reason stated for eliminating the thresholds. DHS has raised questions regarding some therapy being provided up to the limit one-time threshold and then stopped. Why couldn't DHS retro-review these cases to determine if therapy continued when it was not medically necessary and send the case to SIRS for investigation? Let's find out what the problem is before the state eliminates thresholds and invests in a $1 million computer system that may not solve the perceived problem.
Thank you, Ms. Sames. Mr. Chita, and following his testimony, we've got a couple of people from professional rehab consultants, and it doesn't look like John Chita is here, but please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Cindy Goodall from Courage Center, and Mr. Chita asked me to testify on behalf of Courage Center. And I wanted to talk about the governor's proposed cuts to medical assistance and specifically services for people with disabilities from the perspective of a Courage Center client. For people with disabilities, Medicaid is more than just health insurance or even medical services. It touches their life in almost every aspect. The services and care it provides is their lifeline to independent living, a life that we all want for ourselves and our family members, a home, a purpose, the opportunity to connect with others. These are not nice things to have. They are the difference between spending the prime years of your life in an institution or living in the community. The cuts the governor is proposing is putting this fragile balance of needed services and supports in jeopardy for individuals with disabilities. They all work together, and when one service is no longer available or reduced, it can upset all other areas of their life. These services can mean the difference between having someone available to get you out of bed or lying in bed all day long, having a nutritious meal delivered to your home, or just eating a bag of chips because it's the only thing that you can grab, having the services to help you find a new apartment when you can no longer navigate the 2 flights of stairs up to your home, or having a nurse so you don't take the medications wrong and wind up in the ER, or getting the rehabilitation therapies that you need to maintain your mobility and functioning after a stroke or the onset of MS, rather than waiting for the red tape to finally be navigated to get authorization with the new prior authorization system. While you're waiting for that authorization, you're going backwards in your functioning. When the legislature passed cost of living increases in the past, they have always tied them to salary and benefit increases for direct care staff. With another rate decrease on top of previous cuts, it is impossible to decrease costs without cutting staff positions or wages and benefits. Wages and benefits in disability services are already very low compared to the labor market. These are very cost-effective and efficient services, and there isn't much fat to cut off. Decreases in staff positions or increases in caseloads will mean real decreases in the amount and quality of care that our clients receive within the whole system. And this disruption can possibly kick out one or two of the supports from underneath the person and upsetting the balance that they're trying to maintain to stay living in the community. Also, as the economy picks up, people in these jobs, if they are experiencing some wage and benefit decreases, will be leaving for other jobs in other completely different sectors, and positions will go open and will upset the service availability and provision. At Courage Center, we'll be affected by the home and community-based services rate cuts, the cuts and increased fees to our inpatient rehabilitation program, which is licensed as a skilled nursing facility, and then the increased red tape to get prior authorization for therapy services. So we are looking at a negative impact in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for our organization, on top of the $400,000 annualized cut last year, on top of the $400,000 cut that we received the year before. These cuts year after year are unsustainable for providers, which means they're unsustainable for the people that we serve.
Thank you. Appreciate your coming this afternoon. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Lindsay Ginter and Susan Syverson from Professional Rehab Consultants. Following them, Tom Pollack, Park River Estates Care Center. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Lindsay Ginter, and I'm an occupational therapist who works for Professional Rehab Consultants, the main provider of specialized maintenance therapy. Governor Dayton's proposed budget eliminates specialized maintenance therapy for Minnesota healthcare programs. I'm here requesting that you strongly reconsider this issue. At PRC, we provide OT to over 300 people with serious and persistent mental illness, including but not limited to schizophrenia, chronic depression, borderline personality disorder, making them some of the most highly vulnerable and least able to advocate for themselves. Our treatments have always been regulated. All treatment is doctor-ordered, meets strict guidelines to qualify as medically necessary, and is continuously reviewed and authorized by DHS. In opposition to claims made in the governor's proposal, this is not basic skill building, which can be replaced by another unskilled service. When you hear Susan's testimony, you will see that her progress could never have been achieved by a personal care attendant. The proposal identifies unskilled PCA services as an alternative to our program, but as of 8-1, mental health symptoms no longer qualify somebody to receive a PCA. It's critical that we provide training to increase their ability to care for themselves in the least restrictive and therefore most cost-effective environment. Based on the complicated factors of the mental illness, in combination with a high percentage of our clients also experiencing cognitive deficits or physical ailments, our clients require specialized maintenance therapy for routine building and reinforcement of learned skills. They need more than just acute care for long-term carryover. They need support and assistance to problem-solve stressors, fluctuating symptoms. This is the very reason that this provision was put into place. Without this treatment, many clients will require more costly crisis support, including hospitalizations, frequent use of the ER, loss of their independent living, or they'll resort to previous destructive behavior patterns, including drug use, self-injury, suicide attempts, or they'll end up off necessary medication, often resulting in homelessness or larger safety concerns. If you flip to the middle of my handout, you'll see a chart outlining the changes in our clients' use of crisis services since initiating specialized maintenance therapy. You can look through all of this, but you know, one client spent 45 days in the hospital in 2008, almost lost her young child. She hasn't been hospitalized now since December of 2008. She's providing a stable home environment, taking care of her kid. Another one was in the hospital 23 separate times, hasn't been hospitalized in 10 years, coming to OT one time a week. When you consider that the cost of treatment two times a week for an entire year is approximately the same as 2 days in the hospital, these cost savings are staggering. The first example I get, we estimate she was $230,000 that year in hospital bills versus $3,000 for an entire year of OT. As you consider whether to eliminate specialized maintenance to fund development of a new computer system for DHS, please consider whether more bureaucracy is worth the expense of treatment. Representative Huntley spoke nationally after the tragedy in Arizona, commending the great job Minnesota does in treating the mentally ill population. I believe that this specialized maintenance is one of those treatments which should be copied nationally, not eliminated. Without skilled training, their mental illness symptoms will escalate, and they will rely on more costly services within the state system. It would be a disservice to the taxpayers to eliminate treatment which is so cost-effective and which provides people, the vulnerable people, the skills they need to care for themselves, fostering a system of independence rather than dependence, both now and in the future. Sincerely, thank you for your time. Now Susan's going to give some testimony about her personal experience with specialized maintenance.
Thank you, Ms. Ginter. Ms. Syverson?
Yes. Good afternoon. I'm going to leave it to you to read the full of my testimony and give you the, I'm kind of nervous, so I'm going to give you the Reader's Digest condensed version. But I have to say hi to Senator Marty. I'm one of your constituents. So when I first started coming to PRC, I had spent 2.5 years homebound, virtually not able to leave my apartment for sometimes a month at a time. And I slowly, gradually worked into going to OT. I had an escort going with me the first 4 months I was there, but I've learned to overcome a lot of the agoraphobia, and I've been able to come by myself now since then. And now I even drive myself there. When I started at PRC, I was really behind with things like taking care of my apartment, taking care of myself, and now I maintain both my apartment and myself. I was hospitalized 11 times out of 13 months. I went to the emergency room, and out of that, I was hospitalized 7 times. It's been 2.5 years now since I was hospitalized. I took a fall and had surgery on my shoulder, and PRC provided me with the ability to exercise on the premises and do my physical therapy there. I guess one last thing that I'm really proud of is that after 12 years, I work now. I'm a teaching assistant for special education children in the Roseville School District. And I wouldn't have that job. I work one day a week there. But I wouldn't have that job if it wasn't for PRC, because they helped me with writing a resume. They helped me with mock interviews and going through the different interview process and practicing. And we did follow-ups after interviews. And so basically, in summary, is I want to say that PRC is an organization that provides me and others like me who live with mental illness a wide variety of services to help us cope with our daily life. It's essential for many of us who require an ongoing support system to live in a productive and positive manner. This type of program is not available in any other form through any other place, because I sure looked for it during those 2.5 years that I was homebound. So thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for coming, and you did just great. Would never have known you were nervous at all. So I wish you continued success.
Okay.
Thank you for being here. Next we have Tom Pollack. And is it Donna Fleta?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Tom Pollack, the administrator at Park River Estates Care Center in Coon Rapids. And I do have some handouts for some of the information I'm going to be covering today. The cumulative impact of Governor Dayton's proposed cuts will be an average of 3.89% on nursing homes. On top of the 1% cut to the rates, the budget cuts nearly $45 million from Minnesota nursing homes and assisted living providers. There is an additional $26 million increase in the nursing home surcharge or granny tax as well, to help balance the budget. 10% cut is going to the lowest need case mix for the nursing homes, which results in $6.95 million. Other changes that have a cumulative effect eliminates new plan closure rate adjustments and single bed incentives for facilities that want to provide that privacy. Reduces bed hold payments to 30% of the established rate. And yet we still have to have, it's actually increased to 96% occupancy for the month, and we're still required to hold that bed for 15 days. Reduces the payments for single bed rooms for medical necessity from 11.5% to 5.5%. I had mentioned before about the surcharge. On October 1st, it'll increase by an additional, or for a total of $3,800 per bed, and not one penny is directed back to the nursing home. In my specific facility, that means I will pay $375,000 back to the surcharge. Cuts to the nursing homes will kill jobs and reduce wages and benefits. Minnesota nursing homes and assisted living providers contribute to over 112,600 jobs and $6.7 billion to our state economy. 70% of provider budgets go to wage and benefits for their employees. And every state dollar that is cut from care centers result in $3 cut from nursing home budget, because the cuts that are proposed have a triple impact on seniors in the nursing homes. The state's failed rate equalization policy mandates that nursing home providers charge private pay residents the same as Medicaid rates, which means each dollar of Medicaid cut from nursing homes equates to a loss of $3 in revenue. All of these cuts come in a time when nursing homes are already reimbursed $20 a day less than what their cost is. When we talk about millions and billions of dollars, it's hard to get a handle on that, so I'm going to specifically let you know what it does to Park River Estates Care Center. Our average Medicaid rate is $16.75 less than what our cost is. The budget of the governor now reduces my payment over the next 2 years of an additional $60,000. Our cost back in 2010 was $174 per resident per day. That's $7.28 per hour, which is 3 cents over minimum wage. Our Medicaid rate was $157 a day. That's $6.58 per hour, or 67 cents less than minimum wage. According to DHS, the statewide average nursing facility daily rate effective October 1st, 2010 was $165.14, or $6.88 an hour. To illustrate the impact that inflation has, since 2002, inflation in aggregate has increased over 21%, and Medicaid rates have only increased 5.56%. So what that means for an employee of mine who bought an item for $20 back in 2002, it now costs them $4.24 more, while the increase in wage gives them an additional 83 cents. Consumers and regulators expect us to provide Cadillac care, but it's very difficult when we receive Pinto payments.
Thank you. Ms. Flato?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Donna Flotta, and I'm an executive director with Brookdale Senior Living. Brookdale operates in 17 communities in Minnesota. We're located in Blaine, Winona, Plymouth, Minnetonka, Eden Prairie, Edina, Egan, Inver Grove Heights, West St. Paul, North Oaks, Sauk Rapids, Wilmer, Mankato, Faribault, Owatonna. We service the needs of more than 760 older adults in Minnesota. I'm here today to express my concern about the deep cuts to the older adult services proposed by the governor. His revised budget would cut $53 million out of the vital older adult service programs. This means an average of 4.8% cut to nursing homes and assisted living establishments. I will focus my comments on the governor's budget proposal as it relates to the Elderly Waiver Program, which is a medical assistance program that pays for long-term care services delivered outside a nursing home setting. Since I will not be able to cover all of the cuts that impact the Elderly Waiver Program, the Long-Term Care Imperative has prepared a handout that summarized all of the cuts to the older adult services. Most troubling is the Governor Dayton's proposal to cut customized living component rates by 2%. The Elderly Waiver Customized Living Program is a medical assistance program that pays for services in settings commonly known as assisted living. Under this proposal, rates for component services included under customized living and 24-hour customized living services would be reduced by 2%. The Elderly Waiver Customized Living Program has taken deep cuts in the past biennium. In 2010, Customized Living received a 5% cut. No other waiver service received this cut. Customized Living was singled out for the cuts. In the Brookdale communities alone, the annualized impact of the 5% reduction in 2010 on the 2011 budget is $233,000. An additional 2% cut in 2011 would add another $100,000 to the reduction of revenue. At many companies, these types of reductions potentially impact jobs, capital reinvestment, and elimination of wage increases. This revenue cannot be recovered in other ways. Expenses for utilities, insurance, food, wages, and all other supplies and services increased by 3.9% in 2010, with the same projected and budgeted for 2011. In 2009, the program was also included in a 2.58% reduction passed by the legislature. In addition to legislatively mandated cuts, the program has been further negatively impacted by the recent implementation of the customized living tool and reductions in the monthly budget amounts available to pay for individuals' client services. Cuts to this program will have huge impacts on seniors. In some communities, all of the clients in assisted living establishment are on the elderly waiver program. Other providers may find that they can no longer afford to service elderly waiver clients. As a result, these cuts will limit seniors' access to affordable alternatives to nursing home care. Serving seniors in settings such as assisted living and other homier and community-based settings is extremely cost-effective. On average, assisted living is half the cost of nursing home care. In addition to the rate cut to the elderly waiver customized living rates, the governor has also proposed reduction to resources to pay for senior care. For example, the elderly waiver case mix L individuals, their budget caps would be reduced by $522 a month, from $2,272 per month to $1,750 a month. While the needs of these individuals do not change, they would have fewer resources to pay for the services that they need. The governor's proposal will also make higher needs clients to qualify for 24-hour customized living by increasing the thresholds currently that are 2 activities of daily living services to increase it to 3 activities of daily living services. Overall, the governor's proposal cuts to the elderly waiver program would be a step backwards from the reform Minnesota has sought over the past several years. We have rebalanced our long-term care system to ensure cost-effective options for seniors to receive quality care. These cuts would jeopardize the system. This year, the baby boomers turn 65. That's significant because it marks the beginning of a significant change in Minnesota's demographics. By the year 2020, Minnesota will have more seniors than school children. While I know there are difficult decisions that you all must make to balance this budget, please know that the outcome of this budget debate will have a profound impact on our ability to be prepared to address the needs of our aging population. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Flotta. Apologize for not pronouncing your name correctly earlier. Appreciate your both coming here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Peterson from Lutheran Social Services, followed by Austin Figg. I hope I pronounced that correct, Prairie River Home Care. Mr. Peterson.
Chairman Hahn, members of the committee. I'm Mark Peterson. I'm the CEO at Lutheran Social Service. We are Minnesota's oldest and largest human service organization. After 146 years, we think we've learned something about the delivery of human services. We serve 100,000 persons each year. We have persons that we serve from every legislative district in the state. We contract with each of the 87 counties for something. This afternoon, I want to limit my remarks to a few of our services with respect to supports for older adults. as it relates to the governor's supplemental budget. Senior companions and foster grandparents have been a service in this state for 40 years now. The data that support the effectiveness of this service is fairly overwhelming in terms of helping to keep active older adults active and healthier longer and forestalling the need for frail older adults to enter the long-term care institutional setting. In the last several years, this service from the state of Minnesota has experienced rate reductions or grant reductions, and the governor's budget proposes that again. Last year, our senior companions transported frail older adults over 1 million miles of getting them to the doctor, to the grocery store, and other places around town so that these folks can continue to live in the community. Reductions in grants mean reductions in service, which in my book ends up meaning greater cost to the state with respect to institutional care for older adults. The same is true with respect to senior nutrition services, both with respect to home-delivered meals and congregate dining. We have had grant reductions in these services over the last several years. The governor's proposal continues that pattern, creating a greater nutritional threat for older adults. And the last subject with respect to older adults, our respite care services. We provide a series of respite services for caregivers who are caring for their frail loved ones in their own home, forestalling the need again to enter the institutional forms of care. Reductions in this service also have a direct result with respect to creating more need for institutional services. Lastly, I have met with many of you and with most of your colleagues in the legislature with respect to a proposition that we have for persons with developmental disabilities, a proposal that we call My Life, My Choices, which we believe represents a significant redesign for how service for this population can be delivered over the next several years. I thank you very much for the leadership that you've exhibited in supporting this. We believe this is an important proposition for this population and for the people of Minnesota, so important that earlier this year we produced with Twin Cities Public Television this video called Institutions to Independence. You should have a copy of that in front of you. We encourage you in the wee hours of the morning to look at this 26-minute video. It tells, I think, an extraordinary story of how this population has moved from institutions to independence, and it's time now to take the next step. So thank you very much for listening, and if you have questions or comments, I'm all ears.
Well, thank you, Mr. Peterson, for coming today and for the leadership that you've brought to your organization. We, of course, appreciate very much the work that you do and what Lutheran Social Services has done for Minnesota.
Thank you very much.
So thank you for being here today.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for being here.
I brought some copies of my testimony because I'll probably get nervous and really read it fast. My name is Austin Figge, and I represent Prairie River Home Care. We have 8 offices servicing approximately 1,200 patients with 650 employees during an average week. Most of these clients are on Medicare, Medicaid, or a state HMO program. My company is a little unique in that we are a Medicare-certified agency that services mostly rural communities in central and southern Minnesota. I'm here testifying today to illustrate the effects of the governor's budget cuts to the patients we serve. The home care business depends on the availability of qualified caregivers, and the wages for those caregivers are its largest expense. Reimbursement cuts directly affect the prevailing wage that home care companies can offer. The home care industry has weathered cuts in reimbursement for the last 3 years from Medicare and Medicaid. These cuts occur at the same time more and more patients are being cared for in their homes. Sometimes we can't compete with unemployment because the benefits are better than the wages we can offer. Combined with the fact that gasoline costs are skyrocketing, it's becoming increasingly difficult to find qualified caregivers for people in need. The reality is that most home care businesses run very tight margins, and when rate reductions occur, they are generally passed on to employees. The rural patients are the most vulnerable due to the increased transportation costs and rising gasoline prices and falling wages of caregivers. These rural clients are often isolated, and without help of in-home caregivers would deteriorate quickly and soon move to a more costly institutional care, not to mention a reduced quality of life. Imagine a home health aide that visits an aging farmer in rural southwestern Minnesota. She makes a visit in the morning to help him get up and going for the day, and another in the evening to help him to bed. Critical help to keep him independent at home. Say she drives 25 miles each way. Her driving expense has risen from $4 just over a couple of years ago to over $7, and it is still rising. Now, $3 doesn't sound like much, but that's twice every single day. Pay is approximately $10.50 an hour. She works 5 hours per day every day. She used to take home $40 a day. Now it's $34, and another 2% reduction, possibly dropped to $33 a day. This employee has seen a 17% reduction in take-home pay. While most of that are gasoline costs, it is still the reality of the situation. If take-home pay drops 15 to 18%, it will be increasingly difficult to find people to care for that farmer, and he will end up in a more expensive care delivery model. Assistant Commissioner DHS Lauren Coleman was quoted in the Star Tribune last month saying that in the long term, it is generally cheaper and more effective to help people in home and community-based settings instead of institutions. Thankfully, there are still caregivers out there who are doing their jobs because they like to help people, but to continue to cut into their paychecks just makes it harder for them to continue. Home care is the most cost-effective method of caring for people, and most people tend to prefer it over institutionalized care. Any additional reduction in reimbursement combined with rising fuel costs will make it even more difficult to keep patients out of institutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Figge, for coming here this afternoon. Prairie River Home Care, where exactly is that?
Our corporate office is in Buffalo, Minnesota, but we have branch offices in Marshall, Mankato, Rochester, Hutchinson, Blaine, Rogers, St. Cloud. I don't know if that was eight, but it was around there.
All right. Thank you for your testimony.
No problem. My pleasure.
Next, we have Mary Nino from Child Care Works. Welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Nino. I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. We are a statewide child care advocacy organization whose mission is to achieve and sustain high-quality child care options for families and communities. Child Care Works is a founding member of Minnesota's Future, a coalition of early childhood organizations, many of whom are here today, along with a number of parents, child care providers, and teachers joining us for this important conversation. As you know, child care is an essential job support. Child care not only allows parents to work, but also enables employers to recruit and hire parents, reduce absenteeism, and increase productivity. Making smart investments in early childhood programs increases the quality of children's learning and development and lays the foundation for their future success in school, career, and life. 90% of brain development occurs before the age of five, and early experiences, including those in childcare settings, literally shape how the brain is built. Because we know how important childcare assistance is to working families and the over 14,000 childcare small business owners across the state, Child Care Works would like to raise some concerns about the governor's proposals listed in pages 30 to 34 pertaining to the Child Care Assistance Program. We agree with the governor that simplifying the program and strengthening its program integrity are important goals. However, limiting absent day payments and denying additional payments to providers that serve families who work non-traditional hours will make participating in paid work more difficult for struggling families. I had hoped to have a provider here with me today, but as you can imagine, they are taking care of kids. So I have a family child care provider from Moundsview who wrote to Child Care Works saying, "Most of my parents could not work without help paying for daycare. Also, I do 24-hour care for a fireman and a nurse. There are all kinds of jobs that need daycare for all hours. I have talked to a lot of different people that would prefer we pay for daycare in an effort to keep parents off of welfare." I've provided you a packet. It's a red folder, and in it you'll find the list of the 4,000 families that are currently on the waiting list for sliding fee subsidies to afford child care. Child Care Works opposes the proposal that takes $5 million in the basic sliding fee program from vulnerable children in order to reduce our budget deficit. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Having served this committee for nearly 4 years, I understand deeply the difficult budgetary decisions you are facing. I hope you will view child care assistance as a way to improve our future economic recovery while also providing quality early learning experiences for our children. If there is anything that I or Child Care Works can do to be of assistance, please do not hesitate to call upon us. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Nell Hurley, Minnesota Recovery Connection. Thank you for coming, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Nell Hurley. I'm the director of a nonprofit organization here in the Twin Cities called Minnesota Recovery Connection. Minnesota Recovery Connection works to strengthen the recovery community, and we connect individuals and families to the resources that they need in order to enter and sustain long-term recovery from addiction to alcohol and other drugs. But I'm also before you today myself as a woman in long-term recovery. What that means for me is that I have not taken a drink or a drug in over 13 years. So I'm here to help put a face. Thank you. I'm here to help.
Just members of the audience, I appreciate your support of our witness, but please, we want to make sure we can move expeditiously and give time to everybody who's here. So please refrain from demonstrations while we're having testimony. Thank you. Please continue, Ms.
Please behave, people. I'm here to help put a face on recovery and a voice on recovery in case there are people here who might not understand what that means or what that looks like. So why does this matter? Well, as we all have, I'm sure you've seen the face of addiction in our society, especially if you've turned on your television in the last week. You know the painful cost of addiction, and you've seen the consequences of this disease over and over again. And I was once part of this problem. However, today, as a member of the recovery community, I'm no longer part of this problem. To the contrary, I am employed. I pay state and federal income taxes and contribute to Social Security. I'm college educated. I obtained a master's degree on a full scholarship from the University of St. Thomas, and I'm currently in the middle of my second graduate program, this time at Hamline University in St. Paul. I quit smoking and became a five-time marathon finisher. I'm a certified yoga instructor, and today I provide a free weekly yoga class to other men and women in recovery from addiction. In my recovery in the last 13 years, I have not once visited a hospital emergency room. I have not compromised the safety of myself or others by driving drunk. I have not provided drugs to others or alcohol to minors. I have not been arrested. I have not been incarcerated. I have not lost my faculties or my rights. I am a voter, and except for a couple of parking tickets, I obey the law. Also, very importantly, I'm an engaged, attentive, and loving mother to my child. This is a picture of my son. His name is Jasper. He's 6 years old, and he has never once seen me under the influence or hungover. I've achieved this simply because I was afforded the support I needed in order to recover from my disease. As state legislators, when you enact any public policy that promotes the solution to addiction, and especially in funding access to treatment for those who can't afford it independently, you not only help addicts and alcoholics, people like me, but you strengthen the recovery community itself, you provide much-needed recovery resources to your constituents, and ultimately you enrich Minnesota as a whole. Because just as addiction affects all of us, recovery benefits everyone. I'm not the only face of recovery here today. There are many, many others. Some of us have identified ourselves by wearing these stickers that say, I'm in recovery and I vote. Not everyone who is wearing this sticker is in recovery. You may see people wearing the sticker who is a family member of someone who's in recovery or an employer of a person in recovery or a neighbor or a friend of a person in recovery. I know we don't have time to hear from everyone, so I urge you to take the time to read the written testimony from others in the recovery community that we've provided to you. I think you all have this packet in front of you. Please support recovery from addiction and the recovery community in Minnesota in every way that you possibly can. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hurley, for being willing to come today to offer your testimony. And we, of course, I personally would congratulate you on your progress and your recovery. I think I certainly know, and I would bet most people know or have family members that also have had struggles with addiction. And it's always encouraging to see people who have made so much progress. So thank you for your being willing to come here today.
Thank you.
Next, Dave Zook. Hope I've got your name correct, from Regions and Health Partners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Juck. I currently serve at...
Excuse me, Mr. Juck. Apologize for mispronouncing your name, but could you bring the microphone closer and sure. Make sure we get your remarks on tape?
Is that better? Can you hear
better.
Me?
Better. Thank
okay.
you.
My name is Dave Juck, and I currently serve as the Chief Financial Officer for Health Partners. Health Partners is an integrated delivery organization, and we have both health plans as well as hospitals and clinics, primarily in the metropolitan area, Minneapolis and St. Paul. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My testimony today will be primarily focused on the proposed surcharges that are included in Governor Dayton's budget recommendations. And I'll talk about two pieces, the impacts to Minnesota licensed HMOs, which we have two of them, and then I will also talk about the impact to Regions Hospital, our hospital just down the street. So first, the HMO medical care surcharge included in the governor's budget recommendation raises the tax on HMO premiums in Minnesota from 0.6% to 4.3%. It's about a 700% increase in the tax. This tax increase is partially offset by increased Medicaid payment rates, but because Health Partners covers proportionately more commercial members in its HMO relative to its Medicaid members, we will be disproportionately impacted by this tax. Pretty dramatically. We estimate the impact to our organization of about $70 million over the biennium. For our commercial business, this is a big impact, and it constitutes a direct tax increase from basically a 3.7% increase with no offsetting dollars. Under this proposal, taxes and assessments, which are currently included in commercial member premiums, will go up from approximately 4.1% to 7.8% of premiums, and this will make our HMO products pretty much uncompetitive in this market. Insurance companies, which are not affected by this tax, are currently paying about 4.5%, and self-funded employers are also not affected by this proposed tax and currently do not pay taxes and assessments. So under the proposed budget recommendation, hopefully you could see that Health Partners, HMOs, would be significantly disadvantaged as employers would choose other low-cost options outside of the HMO market products. Next, I'd like to talk about the hospital MA surcharge and the other hospital cuts. The governor's proposed budget recommendation also disproportionately impacts Regions Hospital, downtown St. Paul. The hospital MA surcharge is proposed to increase from 1.56% to 4.45%. It's about a 285% increase in the tax. The offset mechanism included in the proposed surcharge would result in hospital payment, in our hospital payments, hitting the federally established upper payment limit This will make it significantly harder for regions to draw down federal health care dollars. Unlike other previous surcharge proposals that the state has implemented, this one will have a direct impact on the hospital's cost structure because the money is not being returned to the hospitals in the form of higher payment to offset the increased tax. So there will be a direct tax increase on Regents hospitals as well as other community hospitals. We estimate the impact of this tax increase and the resulting rate cuts would be a loss to Regents of over $40 million over the next biennium. This is in addition to over $20 million in cuts that we received in the last biennium and the losses that we also incurred as one of four hospitals in our state that chose to partner with the state on the Coordinated Care Delivery System program. And those losses amounted to, for our organization, about $500,000 a month in 2010 and the first few months of 2011. As you know, Regents Hospital is a teaching hospital. It's a level one trauma center for both children and adults. We provide burn care and behavioral health care services on the east side of St. Paul. We are a safety net hospital. Approximately 55% of our revenue comes from government sources. We provide a disproportionate share of charity care, second only to Hennepin County in the state of Minnesota. The economic downturn over the past couple of years has led to increased charity care. In 2010, our charity care increased to $29 million. We provided charity care to about 28,000 patients who came from 85 out of 87 counties in Minnesota. It's about a $10 million increase, about a 30% increase over 2009. As you think about strategies to weather the state fiscal storm, Regions and Health Partners is to committing and ensuring that reductions don't impact the care at the bedside and the safety of our workforce. However, cuts of this magnitude are unsustainable over time. Again, we'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify today. We know the current budget shortfalls means we all need to be part of the solution, and we are ready to do our part, but we are concerned about the inequity of the cuts across the industries, both the insurance industry as well as the hospitals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jook. Appreciate your coming today to testify. Next, we have Chris Bell, Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chris Bell, and I am the co-chair of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. As I have listened to other speakers this afternoon, I realize how blessed I have been to have had access for my entire professional life with group health insurance. So I haven't had to rely on Medicaid, and I haven't had to experience the kinds of budget cuts. Yet I have experienced and used many of the services that people on medical assistance who've testified this afternoon have used. I was born in 1951. I weighed 2 pounds, 12 ounces, and had 26 weeks of gestation. That resulted in my blindness. It also caused me significant brain damage. As a result, I've been diagnosed with nonverbal learning disabilities, general anxiety disorder, chronic depression, and a variety of other difficulties. I have been a victim of child sexual abuse. And like Ms. Hurley, I am an alcoholic, and I've been in recovery for 8 years. I tell you all of these very personal things because I want to make clear that without the many types of therapy that I've received, and I've probably received every kind of therapy there is, occupational therapy, physical therapy, rehabilitation therapy. I spent a month in a psychiatric hospital for depression and treatment related to my incesting as a child. I've had psychiatric treatment, psychological treatment. I take lots of drugs legally. And all of those essentially have enabled me to testify here today and have practiced law for 24 years, eight of them in private practice as a managing partner of a local office. So the point is that these supports make a difference. We know there will be cuts to programs and services for people with disabilities and the aging communities. But the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities believe that it is important to consider what really is at stake. We are talking about the ability of tens of thousands of Minnesotans with disabilities and older persons to live as independently and as self-sufficiently as we can with our limitations in the community. We know that the governor's amended budget proposal is only the beginning. We are afraid that any final budget compromise will result in even more severe cuts to the benefits and services that people with disabilities and the aging community need to be as independent and self-supporting as we can. I've heard a lot of politicians declare that Minnesotans with disabilities and other vulnerable Minnesotans will be protected from drastic budget cuts. So my response is, now is the time for the legislature to take those words to heart and to act accordingly. Someone said that a crisis is a terrible opportunity to waste. We agree. We at the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities have been working with Lutheran Social Services and Mr. Peterson on their tremendous concept, My Life, My Choices, which focuses on person-centered planning and community-based resources. And we will be introducing legislation to promote that excellent concept. Also, we know that real money, saving real money, relates to how do we control medical costs. One of our legislative proposals will focus on improving health care. About 50,000 adults in our Medicaid fee-for-service have absolutely no coordination of medical or social services. We should have a stronger relationship with healthcare home providers or other health providers, and we've been working with the chair to try to provide legislation that will make this a reality this year. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. We appreciate your making the effort to come to our committee and present your testimony. Thank you. Next, Catherine Commit, Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Catherine Commit, and I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, a trade association that is made up of the seven nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. For a number of years, the HHS budget has been a target of many budget cuts. The 2010 legislative session was no different. In the final 2010 budget agreement, many organizations, including hospitals and other providers, had their funding cut. Like these organizations, health plans were also cut by close to $90 million. Similar to the testimony you may hear from hospital systems and other medical providers, these cuts must be made up somewhere. When the government does not adequately reimburse for the cost of healthcare services, the rest of that cost gets shifted to another segment of the market, typically the private commercial market. I have three specific comments today. First, health plan administrative spending for state public programs is already capped at 6.6%. In his budget, the governor proposes reducing the cap even further to 5.3%. We share the goal of keeping administrative costs as low as possible. In fact, health plan administrative costs have been decreasing every year. But the key to further reductions is to reduce the volume of administrative tasks that health plans and county-based purchasing organizations are required to perform. We have all talked about the hundreds of currently required reports and whether they still provide value. This seems like a good place to start. Second, the governor proposes increasing the MA surcharge rate on HMOs from 0.6% to 4.3%. Like testimony you've heard from other healthcare providers, the increase in the MA surcharge affects different health plans differently. The 3.7% surcharge increase will be applied to both commercial and Medicaid business for each HMO. However, the increased rates from DHS to offset the surcharge are only applied to the Medicaid business. Three, the governor proposes an additional across-the-board cut of 2.75% on health plan rates for state public programs. We take the commissioner at her word that this is a placeholder. We understand the administration is encouraging payers and providers to come up with new payment models. Health plans and many providers are currently exploring a number of new payment models that focus on rewarding outcomes and value instead of volume. We agree that these models need to transition to the populations covered by state public programs. While this 2.75% reduction is a placeholder, the commissioner also stated the cut will go into effect if budget savings cannot be achieved through new payment models. As we develop these new payment models, we are learning what works and what does not. Large across-the-board reductions, either to health plans or to providers in the Medicaid program, make it much more difficult to enact payment reform. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Ms. Commit, for your testimony today. Next, we have Norm Monk, Partnership Resources.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, esteemed committee members. And a lot of you have championed the rights of developmentally disabled for years and years as I look around the table. I'm Norm Monk. I'm a CEO of a day program, a small business in the community that provides jobs and works hard for advocating for the rights of disabled individuals. Also a past president of the Minnesota Habilitation Coalition, representing upwards of around 18,000 individuals. Today, I'm not going to read to you, and it's as I listen to the testimony, I thank you for your patience, because it's a brutal time. It's a sad time, and I'm scared. I'm not that young anymore, even though I look sort of young. And I brought three phenomenal people that inspire me, and I believe will inspire you too. And I'll be pretty brief in telling their story. And I'll start on my left with Wea. Wea is developmentally disabled. There's a certain diagnosis that goes with it. Wea is working at a food co-op, Valley Natural Food. Oh, by the way, I've asked their permission to speak for them. Abler's committee was that much faster, so I left sweating. You seem to be giving people a few more seconds, so I appreciate it. So they've given me their kind permission to speak for them. So Wea's working. She's a taxpaying citizen. She also does phenomenal art, not for coloring purposes, but art to advance and raise awareness. You want to show your art, Wea? And we'll talk about that a little bit in a second. Wea also votes, and Wea, as we'll demonstrate, is part of our social entrepreneur effort that we've worked hard on to offset cuts. We raise a ton of money out of what the state gives us through our business efforts to, like I said, to offset cuts and promote programs. This is Kathy. Kathy, about 6 or 7 years ago, I don't remember the exact time, she was at Sister Kenny, and at Abbott, worked at Xerox, and was brutally mugged, and in a way that was indescribable. She came to a program like mine where we found she needed supports. We refound her a job at a cool place called Coolabar. Coolabar does work with sun-resistant clothing for people with cancer. Great job. She's also just a ridiculous artist. She lives on her own, and Kathy loves showing her art. So this art was then turned into cards. These cards we sell, and Target Corporation just picked this up at 1,800 stores nationwide. The point here is we understand these times, so we've worked really hard to make a difference in the community, not only raising awareness, but figuring out a way to make more money for our programs and for these great individuals. This is Chris. He's the backbone, as you know, of so many of our programs. Most of the people in this room are dealing with employees that don't make a lot of money. I think Chris makes between $11 and $13 an hour. Chris returned after just an incredible serious illness because he was dedicated. He hasn't had a raise in 5 years. I've been cutting benefits left and right as sparingly as I can. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to see some people that you worked your brains out over the years. I look at a few of you who are champions and others who are new to really help us to move forward. I'll read my last statement just because I can't remember it all. It says, from institutions to independence, which, by the way, is really a good film. So when you have a few minutes, ha-ha, 2 in the morning, 26 minutes, it's really great. The question is, will we continue to promote changes that we have worked so hard to accomplish together, everyone in this room, on behalf of the citizens with developmental disabilities that I'm surrounded by? Thank you very much for your attention and your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Monk, and thank you for your helpers here in your presentation. We appreciate their being here.
Thank you very much.
Deborah Schlick. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We are a coalition of nonprofits, of faith-based organizations and individuals who advocate for more effective welfare to work and anti-poverty policy. I'm here today to talk to cuts in the governor's supplemental budget that would cut the MFIP Consolidated Fund. The MFIP Consolidated Fund is a fund created in 2003 that is sent to the counties to pay for the state's portion of the eligibility determination workers, for the job counseling services to help parents get back to work in the worst job market we've had in generations, to pay for the emergency assistance that helps families on the verge of homelessness either get out of homelessness or avoid it altogether, and to staff and operate the four-month assistance program, the diversionary work program created under Governor Pawlenty. We know and we're well aware that there are legislators who'd like to see even deeper cuts to the state's income support program for families. And as you consider the governor's budget proposals, as you work to put together your own budget proposals, we'd like to share some information, most of it in writing, not that I'll go through now. But we want you to consider a few things. That the reason parents turn to cash assistance in Minnesota, the most common reason is it's a low-wage worker who's lost a job. So as you think about cuts to the disability system, that are many of the workers who will not collect unemployment insurance but will need to turn to the MFIP program. The other reasons people turn to cash assistance are commonly parents who are fleeing violence in their own home. So they are leaving behind not only homes and belongings but often jobs. And having income support is one way to get through a very dangerous period. And in fact, it's often the fear of destitution, of being hungry, of not knowing where you're going to live, that will leave a woman in a dangerous situation longer than we'd like to see. And finally, disability. Parents with disabilities trying to raise children rely on this program for very meager income support, Parents unable to work because of their children's very serious and demanding disabilities rely on this program for income support. The families who rely on this program, like many of you, would be very happy to see better alternatives, a much more complete unemployment safety net that would not cover just half the unemployed workers in the state, but most of the unemployed workers in the state. A way for parents with disabilities or parents raising children with disabilities to keep their family's economic life whole as they keep their health lives whole. And a way for parents with children to escape violence and not face economic destitutions in making those steps. So we appreciate your time and the hard work you have in front of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick, for being here this afternoon. Members, we have a couple more minutes. I'd like to invite Rick Varco, if he is here, to join us. Maybe not. The next people on the list are Jessica Webster, Rolanda Mason from Legal Aid. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for giving us the opportunity to testify. We are with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. We represent low-income people across the state of Minnesota. We are deeply appreciative that the governor attempted to take a balanced approach to this budget. We do appreciate that. There are still real cuts and real pain in this budget, and since we only have a few minutes, we will only testify to a few of the things that we are concerned about. The one I'd like to testify to is the cut to the consolidated fund. And what Legal Aid has found over the last 7 to 8 years with the consolidated fund is that when you cut the consolidated fund, you are de facto cutting emergency assistance for low-income families. So what is emergency assistance? It is a modest cash emergency assistance program for low-income families who have no assets, who have no personal safety net, and they are facing oftentimes eviction. For those of you who represent families in rural communities, you know that a broken-down car can quickly mean the loss of a job. It can mean the loss of childcare. So emergency assistance within the consolidated fund really helps a number of families avoid becoming destitute. It's a quick oftentimes solution to families that have no assets. And I'll turn to my colleague here, Rolanda Mason.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Rolanda Mason, and I would like to speak in support of the Minnesota CARE program. As you know, the governor's original proposal proposed a cut to that program that would have affected 7,200 people in the state. And we are very pleased that the governor has reinstated that in his budget proposal. And I urge you, as you look at your budget considerations forthcoming, that you will also preserve this vital coverage for the people of our state. The 7,200 people who would have been affected are people who earn between 200 and 250% of federal poverty guidelines. Those are nice numbers, but who are those people really? Well, they're the gentlemen who came into our office just last week. We partner with the Department of Human Services and our St. Cloud and Wilmer offices to assist people who are going through the application process. And we had a gentleman who came in into our office just last week for assistance, and he was sick. He was coughing, and he said he hadn't been able to work in the last couple of days. His employer had sent him home. He had a couple of part-time jobs. That's how he survived. That's how he supported himself and his partner. And his employer said, "You can't work here if you're sick." And he said, "But I can't afford to go to the doctor." And his jobs, he didn't have insurance available through his employer, so he couldn't afford to purchase insurance on his own. So without health care coverage, he was facing a situation where, one, he couldn't work, and without working, he wasn't going to get a paycheck. He was very worried about how he was going to make the rent this month, and he was worried that he and his wife were going to be out on the streets. And he said, "I need health insurance. I need it desperately, because if I don't have it, I'm going to be homeless. I don't know what I'm going to do." He's exactly the type of person who is benefited by the Minnesota CARE program, and it is for the 7,200 people like him across the state who rely on this program and whose very economic survival depends on their access to health care that we urge you in your own considerations to preserve the Minnesota CARE program. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate your being here today. Members, we are going to take up additional testimony tomorrow. I apologize for those of you who are here who are on our list. I hope We were able to communicate to you that we would not likely get through the entire list, but we will start tomorrow at 10:30 and take up where we left off with additional testimony. Thank you for coming, and we are adjourned.